Hello, welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organizations, society, and the world. My name is Andy Blaine. I'm a design leadership coach, designer, educator, and writer. My guest today is Francesca Cortesi, passionate product leader with over a decade of experience in scaling digital products that users love and that drive sustainable growth. She has worked with Europe's fastest growing companies from startups to IPOs, delivering tangible results. Her most recent role was as Chief Product Officer at Sweden's leading property platform, Hemnet, and has just started her own consultancy. Francesca, welcome to Power of 10.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, we met over a sort of comment exchange or a post you wrote on LinkedIn and I comment. We're going to get to it in a minute. I would like to just hear a little bit more about how you got to where you are now. What's been your journey?
I'm going to give you the elevator pitch of my past 15 years, maybe. That's when pretty much I started in a product. That's when I moved to Sweden. I'm originally from Italy. And in my previous life, as I call it, I was not working digital at all. I was working in the fashion world in Milan. And maybe, you know, if you watch The Devil's Wears Prada or these kind of things, you know that that is not digital. It's like you want to be there. You want to be at the show. You want to touch the things. You want to see the catwalks. That's what I was doing in my 20s until I decided to move to Stockholm, Sweden. And there, basically, I accidentally start working with digital. And as accidentally, I stumbled into product. My background is in philosophy, but what I was doing actually is doing, you can call it project management, because all those shows and fashion shows and stuff, is basically a project. You have like a deadline, you have a time, you have people you have to invite, all the things. And I started to do that in Sweden just digitally. And then I realized that I wanted a little bit more. I wanted to understand why we were doing things. And that's when I stumbled into product. And back then, this is when you understand, and I'm really old. Back then, there was nothing. I mean, there was not such a thing of, oh, you'd be a product manager. I mean, there was not that kind of wording for it. A lot of concept that we use today that would be like, product-led growth, growth hacking, product management, or all these kind of things. I mean, we were doing them, but we weren't calling them like that. So I started, I was working in a game company and a community, and I started to be responsible for engagement and retention. So what you would call product-led growth today. I did that and then worked for an e-commerce where I was their second product manager, and I built up together with my colleagues the whole product function. I did my own thing for a while, creating my own little startup that did not work. So I learned a lot what it means to have product market fit and how you should think about that. And then I ended up, as you said, at Hemnet, which is Sweden's biggest property portal, or where you go to buy and sell properties. It's also one of the most apps, the most used apps in the country. And I've been there for 6 years, going through there, building up their product development there as well, IPOing the company, until I realized that we were really good for each other for a long time. Maybe that was like the end of a really nice story. And I starting now my own gig with the idea of helping companies in growth stages, because that's what I'm good at.
Great. We'll get to that in a minute. So we met, as it were. You wrote a post on LinkedIn, and it was about this idea that PMs are not just there you initially said, do you believe that a PM's job is to protect the team and then help them focus on execution, and that product management should own the what and why, and, you know, being the expert around the customer and the business and leaving the how to the team? And you said, you know, I used to think that way, but I realized it kind of blocked innovation, and you kind of had a shift for that. And maybe you could say a bit more about it, and then I'll talk about what my response was and how we then kind of met.
Yeah, we go to the juicy stuff here.
Yeah.
But as I said, I mean, I had the realization kind of in the past months in my career, like understanding, I mean, what's my role, what I want, and where should we go, which made me reflect a lot. And from those reflections, I said, like, when I started, there was not really boundaries for product managers or product management in general. But I would say that even today, the discipline, it's a bit misunderstood. And I believe, personal belief is that you don't have an output at the end of the day of your work. You don't have a design, you don't have a prototype, you don't have a line of code. So it becomes this like rule that is a bit fluffy and it's not well defined. And it creates some frictions, right? So when I thought about when I stepped into product management like 13, 14 years ago, basically what people told me, it was this one-liner. You have to own the why. And then the what and the how will be to the team. So that's your job. That's the expectation of you. That's what you have to do. And that's what I try to do, basically, like being the person that we're collecting all the inputs and try to navigate it and then translate it to the team that will come in only in the very last step. And this is still, I mean, it's a little bit connected to the CEO of the product narrative. It's about, yeah, you know, being this person that is in charge and is the one that is supposed to aggregate information, collect information, process information, and then come with an answer to a team. That's something that I was fed. And that's something that I still see around a lot. But when thinking about it, when working, I mean, that's not reality. I mean, that's not reality for me, because that what that did is that I brought in a lot of competence really late, like my designer lead or designer counterpart that could really work with how user interaction, usability, how will that go in into the user journey, or even the tech feasibility that will become already in, I mean, that will come in when we had already the solution kind of decided, you know, we were going for something. But I realized that they had a lot of great inputs in the earlier phases when we were shaping which kind of answer we should take, right? So that's the old shift. I mean, don't be the one that tries to collect everything, but bring people along with you as early as possible. There is also a threshold in this, because while I was testing in my career this, you cannot bring everyone along at the same time, because otherwise you will be extremely slow. And in Sweden especially, there is this culture of, which is good for many, many ways, but a culture of including a lot of people. And everyone has to have a saying, which is really good in theory, but slows you down a lot. So when time to market of time to values of the essence, you have to find something in between, which I found basically finding one representative from product, one from engineering, one from design, what many people call the product trio, to work together, and also make it really clear that you're in it together. You might have your own competence. There's like the designer that should have the last word on usability, but I mean, the three of you should be one unit. Right. That's like, that was my post was all about. And there were a lot of discussions about it.
There were a lot of discussions about it. And my response was probably like kind of, you know, 500 word emoji shrug, you know, of like, hang on a second, hasn't that always been the case? And so I was kind of surprised to read it, right? Because from someone who's been designing digital for a very long time, I was kind of like, well, this is, yeah, obviously this is kind of how you should work. But obviously as a coach, I'm coaching design leaders, I'm usually, you know, I have a very biased sample, because often people come to coaching because they're having a problem with some other stakeholders. And one of those is commonly the product leadership. It's not always. I mean, I have a lot of coaches who have really good relationships with their product leadership too. And one of the things that goes on with the way you describe that kind of former thing of like, I'm responsible for owning the why and the what, it obviously kind of completely robs the agency from everyone else who's further downstream, which is one of the kind of things I think I've seen go on. And, you know, you've seen it also play out in all the layoffs, where a lot of senior designers have been fired and it's just kind of left a bunch of kind of junior, I'm going to be rude again to those people, but sort of Figma jockeys, people who are executors of those things doing delivery work. And then, you know, they don't really have any input into the how. If anyone can hear a kind of squeaking, it's my dog dreaming. And so, you know, what that's turned, I mean, the worst case scenario is a kind of feature factory, right, where people are just literally, it's like they're kind of just designing widgets coming down the assembly line, and there's not much thought behind it. They're just being told what to do. And it can become very frustrating, but it's very frustrating, obviously, if you're more senior, because you've been used to, you know, contributing to being part of the research, contributing to kind of the why, discovering the why of it, as well as, you know, thinking about the what and all those things. So that was my sort of long response, and we had kind of exchange about it. But one of the things that came up in the comments a lot was people, and it was often PMs saying, yes, but then who owns this? How do things get done if nobody owns this, and if no one's, you know, keeping track of it? What other things did you see in there? Because I've got some thoughts about that, but I wanted to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I think like what you're describing, I mean, in a way, that people that have been working this way have the same reaction that you have. It's like, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Because if you've been working in that way, then you see the impact that it makes.
Yeah.
I mean, when we say, I say a lot, product development is a team sport, and not only in the team. I mean, you have a broader team, like including stakeholders, sales, marketing. I mean, if you don't have distribution from the beginning, then you have an amazing product that is not going to go anywhere. So, I mean, there is a lot of this. But I think that product management is still such a young discipline. And also a lot, I mean, one core fact to this is that product managers do really different jobs depending on the companies where they are. So there is no common view of what product management is or what product management does. There is a lot of context that needs to be applied. And in that context comes expectations. So I believe that you come to the product management line of work if you are like a certain type of person. I mean, you want to make an impact. You're really driven. And I mean, you want to excel the expectation, and it is in yourself, right? So if the expectation is not calibrated, then that's what becomes like, maybe the company, I mean, different perspective, the one that you were describing, that designer that get handled only the very last piece of designing the last thing might feel that he or she is in a feature factory.
Yeah.
While I, as a PM in that company, that I feel like I'm going and talking and putting together, I feel really empowered. So it becomes like this shift of different perspectives. And I think there is also like the narrative that you were pointing at. Oh, if I don't have one person accountable, nothing will get done. But is it really?
Not really, right? Because people have been making stuff for ages and stuff gets done, right?
Also, my experience is that if, let's say that you and I work in the same team, and I mean, we work together as a team, we still divide tasks. You will still have maybe like, oh, you and they go and do some usability test or whatever might be feasible in exactly that moment, right? Oh, we have to, we need to understand if this users will use this product or this kind of things. You will be the person to go to.
Yeah.
Like you are responsible for that part. While if I will be talking with, I don't know, our pricing function or business development to understand how to put, you know, what should be the pricing of this product, or which kind of, what is our ICP or whatever. I mean, I will be the go-to person for those questions.
Yeah.
So even if like there is a team, you could still appoint responsibilities. So that, I mean, that narrative, I don't really get it, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot wrapped up in there. I think one of the things that's different, and the two sort of ways of thinking that you're looking at is the shift from, you know, ownership is, it, you know, you talked about empowerment, but often empowerment can mean taking power off of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very kind of focused around that one person. And it's a bit colonial, actually, in the sense of, well, I'm just going to kind of take this and do this. I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do that without much of much sort of regard for whoever else was already there doing that stuff in the past. You know, and this always happens with disciplines. You know, I mean, design is just as bad at this. But I think there's the difference between that and this idea of ownership versus governance. And, you know, in governance, you have that sense of, here's how we deal with making decisions. Here's how we go about it. Here's who's maybe ultimately responsible for making the call on stuff. Or here's the forums within which we discuss these things. Here's how we discuss those things. And it feels to me that's a very different kind of thing, actually sort of more mature thing than just this idea of, you know, I own this. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's like also this is really contextual to the different companies, right? Mm. And I mean, how big the companies are. In governance and decision, I mean, in governance, there's a lot of decision-making, for example. How do we take decision? And I mean, if we disagree, who will be the last one to make the call? I see this from two perspectives. One, it gives, like, it's more of a psychological, maybe philosophical one. I mean, it gives you this perception that if things do not go right, there's going to be one person. But I mean, in reality, you don't get there often. It's more like you prepare from the beginning to the worst case, and maybe you optimize for the worst case when the worst case doesn't. I mean, it can happen, but that's not what happens normally. The other part, I think it's also connected to ego. You know, it's like I am back to the CEO of the product or whatever. Like, oh, I am the one having the last word. I am the one like putting down the feet. People should come to me because I know better. And there is a lot of, I mean, I've seen this in product management, obviously. I've seen it like beyond product management in companies. And this is a little bit of like, yeah, the factory kind of mindset. Mm. There is like, there are steps and they are linear and this should go in a certain way. And I mean, there's people like kind of like approving things. Mm. Product development and digital development is not, if there's something I've learned, it's not linear.
No.
I mean, you don't go linear. Never. I've never seen that happening. And like trying to fit that in a linear process or linear governance because someone is used to that and has some ego attached to it, I think it's the wrong angle to things.
Yeah. And I gave a talk. I know you've just come back from Product at Heart up in Hamburg with our friends, Petra and Arne. And, I gave a talk a little while ago about the language. It was about mind your product language, actually. And it's like, for me, the thing that drives me nuts, and it's partly because of the service design thing, around that language of even just calling it product, right? My brother is an industrial designer or by trade, you know, originally by training. And all those people who consider themselves actual product designers. But also this, you know, this idea of shipping stuff or delivering, and you don't, right? You don't ship. No one ships code anymore. No one even sent, you know, not really. Nobody really sends stuff out on CDs anymore and all of that stuff. But it's very industrial language. And I think it does make you set up a mental model that it's a linear process. And it does set up that thing that it's like a factory. And in classically in the factory, it's very classist. Classically in the factory, you have the blue collar workers who you know, supposedly unskilled labor, right? And just do what they're told and do the same repetitive task over and over again. You know, and the white collar labor sitting in the glass box, looking down at the factory, kind of in the office, who are the brains? And I think there's still that kind of hangover of that. And I think it's really important to be very, very conscious of those dynamics and the sort of, I guess what I'm saying is actually the kind of history of companies and organizations and how they operate. And yet we've had this very, very dominant narrative from Silicon Valley, mostly around product and about tech. And as you said, a lot of that stuff has come and ways of working and thinking have come from startups and scaling up. It's very different to be in an existing enterprise or, you know, in a government service or doing those things and trying to sort of operate that way. Often it doesn't really kind of work. Yeah, how big was Hemnet?
Yeah, Hemnet, when I started, Hemnet was 60 people. And then when I left a couple of months ago, it was like 180.
Okay. All right. So it's not, but it wasn't like sort of several thousand. Yeah.
And I also, full disclaimer, I have never worked for such big enterprises so far by choice. But I've been coaching people that work with enterprises, like thousands of people. And I think you're completely right. There is this idea. I mean, when the company gets bigger, obviously governance gets bigger because that's just how life works. I mean, you cannot go and talk with your colleagues. I mean, you need to have an overall structure about it. But then it could become that slippery slope that this overall structure is like, we are the thinkers and they are the makers. And if you put on top of that, that maybe some people working in the company have been working that way for many years and have seen that specific ways of thinking and working like going well, like that shift in mindset is not trivial. And especially also become depends a little bit on your personal background. I told about my background didn't come from digital at the beginning. And I mean, you have to adjust quite a while to understand how it is to do digital, how it is to do, in my case, project management in digital. But digital sales from analog sales is different. Digital marketing from analog marketing is different. You told about your brother, you know, like developing a physical product. It's another story than developing a digital product. So it's like, it's a lot about ideas and preconceptions and maybe unlearning what served us well that get and kind of having the humility of understanding like what is our role in all of this that comes into play. And it's hard for every single person. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that is different really with, I mean, I would say services, I would say almost all of the digital products are actually services because they have multiple kind of touch points and they're an ecosystem. But one of the differences between those things, they're never finished, right, either. And I think with a physical product, you know, once it really has come off the assembly line or has been created, it you know, obviously it ages and things, but it doesn't change. It doesn't, you buy a thing or you market a thing and sell it, and then that thing doesn't change. And there's not really an ongoing relationship unless it's to sell that person more or something goes wrong. Whereas software and services, they're just constantly in flux all the time. There's no real sort of end point of it either. I think that's probably one of the bigger difficulties to get your head around if you had that sort of industrial mindset in the past.
Exactly. And I mean, if you couple that with one of the, I mean, for me at least, is one of the most recurring questions is like deadlines. When is this done? Mm. You know, when is like, that is the same mindset. I mean, obviously you need to be able to grasp and have an idea, but that cannot be the first thing you do.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea of the, I mean, you haven't tested with user. You have no idea on the complexity of the code. You have no idea when you start, you know, the architecture. And these kind of things are maybe the less visible, yet the one that creates the most friction, because that's another mindset, you know, to build a cup or whatever you're building. It's like, okay, I know exactly what I have to do, and it's kind of the same thing all over. That's not the same with software.
Yeah, particularly in a new area. I'd like to try an opinion on you.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I mean, you know, it might be unpopular, but I think there's a relative amount of truth behind it, but one bit of it could also be a bit offensive. And it's this, you know, I think, you know, there's been a boom in products has had this kind of massive boom in the last, especially in the last 10 years. It became, you know, often the highest paid role in the organization. I mean, obviously that attracts a lot of people. And my experience has been, you know, that certainly what a bit like in the dot-com boom, actually, in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, you end up getting quite a lot of sort of low-grade people coming in, certainly on the sort of bottom third or even half of a discipline because of that, because it's, you know, it's a gold rush. And that starts to degrade the practice, right? And you were sort of talking about this. It's a new practice, so there's not that much, you know, there is obviously, you know, leading lights out there talking about how to do it well. And there's obviously a lot of people doing it well. But there's also a whole kind of bunch of people just going, well, you know, I think I could just rebadge myself. One of the things about this, and this may be the offensive thing, is if, you know, you make a thing. So if you're a coder and you're kind of, and you're writing code, or if you're a designer and you're making design artifacts, you can kind of tell whether someone, there's a sort of an artifact there that is the signal of whether this person's any good or not. Mm-hmm. You've got a thing to look at. You can say, well, this design's awful. You know, you can point to the typography and the hierarchy or whatever, and the code could be sort of messy and hacky and so forth. I wonder whether with product management, whether there's a thing there where, because you don't have that, whether it's sort of easy for that bottom third that I was talking about to sort of get away with it and kind of not be shown up as not being very good, or whether that is offensive and unfair to product management.
I think, I mean, first, I love the provocative question. I agree. There is a lot of mediocrity. What do you say in English?
Mediocrity. Yeah.
I've seen a lot. I mean, I'm famous for taking forever to recruit because I've seen. I mean, I really have to go through many people to understand. Okay, do they actually do? This is partially because the role of product is different companies. So maybe what I might need is not what you're used to, despite you have that title. but there's also a lot of rebranding, exactly as you were saying. I would say that there is a way of like seeing if you are a good product manager. And that way is that the product that you help shipping create a business impact. Because it's not only, I mean, unless you are a charity or an organization that doesn't have to make money, then your job is actually to create business impact. Are you able to solve a problem and are your clients or users willing to pay for it? And do you impact the top line or bottom line, or do you make it some kind of, you know, difference in the company ecosystem? That is the way of measuring a product manager. And the problem many times is that if we think about those product managers that are there, again, to, you know, okay, my job is to make a backlog 1 to 10, and then we ship this, and then when it's shipped, it's done, then you obviously can hide. Because, I mean, if you come back to me, Andy, and say, okay, but this, Francesca, this thing, I mean, we put X many engineering hours and we spend this amount of time and it's out, but, I mean, we're not making any penny. If something we're losing because we invest all that money and we're not seeing any result, and I say, yeah, well, my job was to ship it and I shipped it, you know, and you're bad because you picked the wrong idea, then, I mean, there is basically you hide. But I mean, if you do real product management, according to me, you have to take responsibility for the impact. You really have to, that's your way of like measuring, the same way that, you know, a designer will be measured like, oh, how is this usable in our app? Or like engineer will be measured, or is this making, you know, our code faster or slower? Is it like connecting with the architecture and et cetera? It all needs to go together. But definitely there's way, especially in as company grow and as company maybe see the role of product in different ways, there's definitely a way of hiding.
Yeah. I wonder if there's an inherent tension there, actually, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, where if, you know, if the thing that you're measured on, the criteria by which you say, you know, you're a good product leader and versus a not very good one, is the impact on the business. And yet we're also saying, but it's a collaborative, you know, process, right? Where everyone is involved in that. So actually, you know, it's everyone who has been responsible for the impact on the business.
For sure.
And the tension there being, as a product leader, in order for me to kind of prove my case for myself, I have to kind of basically state the claim that it was me who had that impact on the business and not the kind of collaborative group. And I wonder if that is part of that tension that we're talking about. Well, you were talking about sort of the ego thing, whether sort of systemically it's kind of set up for that dynamic to happen.
I think it's like a lot of this boils down to mindset. I mean, when you realize, and I came to that realization myself, I will not be able to have that impact by myself. So I cannot claim that I made the impact by myself, because if I, yes, there is like two scenarios or two parallel worlds, right? One world where I do it by myself. So I go and talk to sales and talk to marketing and talk to finance and shape an idea and then task someone to talk to users in the best of case. And then they come back with some result and then I make a choice and then we build it, right? Then I take a lot of burden on my shoulders because I feel that I have to do it. And I kind of like take in people on and off during this process. So they feel that they pitch in, but they never have enough skin in the game. Because again, they can say, oh, I delivered those user interview, or I delivered this design, I delivered this idea. But this doesn't make a product successful. And at the end of the day, that also happens like in different phases. Like in my realization, first I was too close, you know, first it was myself, then I was close to my team. And that is like cutting off almost, or like taking in only on demand distribution and marketing. And I mean, that didn't work either, because we had this product, we were super proud, we put like hours and sweat and tears and blood and everything, we want to make it work. But no attachment from sales. How did you think that went? I mean, it's like you cannot, your role, I always say, I mean, I don't like the CEO of the product kind of thing. I like to think that my role is facilitating And then my role facilitating in product can be on different levels. It can be like if you are a CPO, then your role is like to align everyone on a product strategy, meaning making this really, really hard thing of choosing one bet instead of the other, or like one thing instead of the other, because you're always constantly going to go back and be opportunistic. How do you balance long-term with like more opportunistic thing? So that's your job. And your job, like as you go down until the PM, is like make sure that when you have a problem space to work, you bring in everybody. And it's everybody that succeeds or everybody that fails. And obviously everyone has a different role depending on the specific moment in time when you shape the product. But I mean, you cannot claim that you're by yourself. And you can show the impact, and that impact would have not been creating without you being good at facilitating. So in that way, you really need, you see the difference. If you've been in those teams, you really see the difference of like the product person can make in that perspective. But I mean, you're not, you cannot do it by yourself. And again, it's like a lot of mindset. If you think like, oh, my worth is my value and the value is created by me, then you're like on a slippery slope.
Yeah. It's a very difficult thing, isn't it, to know when you hire someone how collaborative they have been in their past place, because, you know, you can speak to people, but it depends on the reasons why someone has left. It's also equally hard in the other way around when you're interviewing or when you're, you know, you're being the candidate and you want to know how collaborative is this culture, because it's very difficult. You often don't know that until you really get there. I think it's one of the kind of toughest things. It's kind of very hidden. So what you just told me actually was sort of the answer to the next question that I was going to ask, because you said before, well, that's a product management or product leadership, according to me, and you sort of gave your outline of it. You're just starting, or you've started your own advisory consultancy. So what are you aiming to help clients with, and what experience will you be drawing upon to help them?
Yeah, that's like my exciting thing that I'm doing this year. And you probably realize that I'm really passionate about collaboration and how we can do and how we can work together to make an impact. And I've been noticing that product in this lately, as you were describing, became really an hot discipline, but also became a little bit empty in the inside. I have like, which creates a lot of frustration. You have like business people who think that product people only think about users and not how we make money. And then you have like engineers and designer who thinks that product only, you know, are want to decide a bunch of things. So you're like, and you are like those individuals that in product that try to do their best. And they're like, many times burned out and in between and don't really know where to bang their head. So I, with my consultancy, I really want to go in and help and try to lead or help these teams and individual to create better product, but also feel more fulfilled themselves. I specialized in scale-ups. So that's what I'm good at. That's where my experience comes from. So post-market fit, when there is an all new set of things, that's when collaboration becomes important. That's when like how we take decision, then when distribution, that all users and business comes together. That's my space where I'm really good at. And that's what I'm gonna help companies, either like coming in fractionally and helping them for period or for some days a week. Or another thing that I'm really passionate is, we always say that it's lonely at the top, which it is.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, let's be honest. But I also think in my years as at the top myself, I was like, does it have to be that way? I think we can kind of like brush ourselves like a bit of ego out our CPOs and think we don't have to have it all figured out. And we can use some people to bounce ideas and people who have been there. So that's my other thing, like coaching product leaders and product teams to accelerate their time to value and really make it normal. You don't have to have it all figured out.
Yeah.
Nobody has. And if you put that expectation on yourself, you're not going to end well. I was really close myself, like to put it all together. It doesn't work.
Yeah. There's a bit of a culture I noticed you know, also at conferences and stuff, a scene of amongst kind of product leadership of, you know, busyness of kind of crushing it and smashing it, and we do everything, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. There's a sort of pride in that, but I can imagine there's quite a lot of burnout in that too.
Guilty, really guilty. Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, you are by design at the, especially like in these scale ups and growth phases, by design, like really at the interception of so many things. You have like strategy that is like 5 years, and then you have, at some point I had like investors or like quarterly report, and then you have teams, and the teams grows, then you need to understand what it is, you know, that is the fire that like a PM tells you in a 101, or what is the structural problem that you have to address. And then you have your own ego, and then you have like the expectation that others or especially yourself put on you. Recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I've often said with design, I think there is a mix of humility and ego that you have to have. Right? You have to have enough ego to be someone who says, well, I think things could be like this, and I'm going to make a thing and put it in the world. And, you know, fight for those things and support them and say, you know, this should be the thing we should do. At the same time, obviously having the humility to work with other people and be wrong, you know. And I don't think you ever kind of perfectly get the balance, right? It's like kind of balancing on a chair or something, where you're always kind of wiggling around a little bit and go from one side to the other. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you fall off.
Yeah. And also I think it's like we all are personally inclined on one side or the other. But what can be, I think, really important is to have someone to, you know, to bounce ideas with, that can show you, like, they then call you on that side. Oh, now you're tipping too much on this side, or now you're tipping too much on the other side. Have you considered this? And it's a whole other thing. It's a person that have been in that seat, because it can kind of understand what you're going through.
Yeah, my coaching is really similar as well. You know, I have the loneliness thing is a really real thing. I mean, it's I don't know if it's as, you know, the same. You know, one of the things that happens when designers become into leadership role is all their peers are other people who have got much more of a shared business background than they have. Often, I don't know if this is true, maybe for product people too, but it's definitely lonely. But it's also a bit of a self-imposed loneliness, because people, you know, for all obvious reasons, but the culture of work isn't usually a place where you can go, sorry, I don't really understand what we're doing here, or I'm really feeling a bit lost at the moment, because you're supposed to be at the top and know all the answers. But I mean, all of those people are often like that. I think it's really important then to have that space where you can kind of give people that. And then the other thing is, you know, I think it's important to create that safe space, but also to be slightly annoying, right? And to kind of ask people the pointy questions, go, well, you know, who cares about that? And for them to have the moment of really thinking that through in a way that, you know, they maybe don't give time for in their daily work, you know, where they're supposed to all have the answers off the cuff. And often I think, wow, some really big decisions just got made. It's just completely sort of in the spur of the moment then, and everyone just nodded and kind of went on, but rather than taking the time to kind of work them through and think them through.
But that happens quite a lot, because when you're in the midst of things, at certain point, people, I mean, there are so many things, and you work towards something that, I mean, you get frustrated and you just want to move on. And some things are exactly as you say, decide quite quickly. Like, you know, while other takes forever, but I mean, the impact of the two is many times unbalanced. And that's when it requires someone, I mean, external or like with fresh eyes on the question, that can be really beneficial. I mean, I'm guilty of that myself. We spend so much time like upstream sometimes and made like a super quick decision downstream that, I mean, the two things, just looking at it in a more detached way, I would have done completely the opposite.
Yeah. So the person they can do that with is you.
Yeah, or plan. Depending, like, but I think it's like the idea of, if you like are looking for how can we in our team elevate generally like our ways of working, I could be a person to talk with. Or even if you're looking for a product bouncing board, as I call it, that could be also a product to talk to.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with the scale up thing, there are kind of inflection points, aren't there, as you get to certain sizes and things change, and the, I mean, the social dynamic changes as well, obviously. that you start to get at some point. I think, you know, so I found you get to around 80 people and you start not to know everyone in the company mm-hmm. anymore. And that kind of changes everything again, because you're just some annoying stakeholder on the other end of an email rather, or Slack, rather than, you know, a person I know and all of those things.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's so, what I find fascinating, because scaling is like, as product, doesn't have an end. It doesn't have a ceiling. It's just that you have to handle like all the different scale phases in different ways. Mm.
I wish it did, though. I think the conversation about how big is big enough doesn't happen enough, actually, you know, particularly in the kind of state of the planet today as well, of, you know, what size are we comfortable with getting to, rather than just this sort of endless growth thing. We're coming up to time. The show is named after this Ryan Charles Eames film called Powers of 10, and it's all about the relative size of things in the universe. People should go and Google it. It's very interesting. And so I have one small question at the end, which is called One Small Thing, which is, what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
You call it a small thing, but I mean, I think this is an extremely difficult question. I had to think really hard about it. And that's one thing that, two things actually that popped to my head. But the one I will bring up is, I think we could redesign the always on culture. And I mean, it might be a little bit philosophical, but I mean, there is this, if we like scope it to the workspace, there's so much email, Slack, and now with AI, like a lot of like bombarding and a lot of things, which create a lot of pressure and expectation of like being always like on top of things, especially if you work with people that are all over the globe. Then, I mean, you're never done. And that's not healthy, because that's not where you create your headspace and where you can do your best work. So one thing that, I mean, just generally speaking, I mean, just like fantasizing, it could be good, for example, to what would happen if in Slack we are defaulted by offline instead of having to opt in as like, you know, offline or like not available, whatever that is. Or like another thing could be, do notification need to be in like instantaneous? What if like I could decide, okay, now it's my focus time, I get no notifications, like I don't have to, what I do is like I close down everything, but I still have this idea things are happening, right?
It's piling up in the background.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, what if like they will come in batches, for example? I mean, I think it, I mean, having those kind of, it's a new approach. If I stretch it, I mean, I could even have it with products, like, you know, this, why do we have to ping people all the time? Wouldn't be like nice if they would come to our product because it's so valuable for them that we don't have to nudge them all the time. I mean, this idea of like rethinking the always on will be my.
Yeah. It's funny because there's also an old thing. You know, I when people used to get actual mail, post, you know, people would often have their sort of correspondence tray and they would kind of batch it and then they would kind of go, okay, I sit down. And one of the things was, I knew someone who said, I answer my correspondence. She said, she was my babysitter as a kid. She was already quite old then. Answer my correspondence strictly, you know, chronologically, you know, whoever comes in, I answer that one next and go through that way. And she would sort of batch it out. And people used to do that. And I think, you know, in the early days of email, certainly in Europe and in America, it's slightly different because of the way phone calls work. But in Europe, where you were paying always for the amount of time you were online, you know, you used to write your emails, go online, send them all, and then go offline again in the days of dial-up. And you didn't have that always-on culture either. And I know there's a few email kind of programs that started to do that again. It's funny to see that stuff come back.
Yeah, in circle. And I think it's like this always-on, always. I mean, obviously, like it's a problem for mental health, but it also like we're not putting the time on the most important things because there's so much to be handled all the time that, again, we're not making the right impact. Yeah, so can we, I mean, can we do something about it?
Yeah, there's not much differentiation sometimes. I call that sort of busy work thing, the junk food of work, right? Where it's like, you're sort of snacking on all this stuff, but it's not, none of it's really nutritious.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we need the
junk
food, you know, the slow food, you know, the Italian slow food
movement.
With work. Where can people find you online?
They can find me on LinkedIn. That would be like the easiest way of finding me. It's Francesca Cortesi, or my website, which is my name, francescacortesi.com.
Wonderful. You say your name so much better than I just mangled it at the beginning. Francesca, thank you so much for being on Power of 10.
Thank you, Andy, for having me.
You've been watching and listening to Power of 10. You can find more about the show on Pauline.com, where you can also check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, as well as sign up for my very irregular newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you've got any thoughts, put them in the comments or get in touch. You'll find me as @apauline on pkm.social. You'll find me on LinkedIn and on my website. I am no longer on Twitter anymore. I deleted my account the other day. It'd been frozen for a very long time, but I finally decided to just get rid of it. All the links will be in the show notes. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.